y'all got things that hang on the back. Things that make us cool, things that make us whack, things that make us mad. Things we wish we never had done. But they're just the things that make us real. Not the maps to guide where we go from here. The road twists and braids like hair until we all get there.
Good morning, it's the Larry Miller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and we're on the eve of a big food holiday. And we thought we'd take this next hour to celebrate some of our favorite foods in the United States and across the Americas with our guest, Jessica B. Harris. Jessica B. Harris is an educator, historian, and author. She's authored, edited, or translated 17 books, including High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America, which was adapted into a Netflix docuseries a couple years ago. Her most recent, Braided Heritage, Recipes and Stories on the Origin of American Cuisine. And we hope you'll join the conversation as well with the stories of the meals that mean the most to you, that have been passed down from generation to generation, where they come from and why they're so delicious each and every time. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@wpr.org. And Jessica, welcome to the Larry Miller Show.
Oh, thank you so much, Lee. Thank you for having me. I have to begin by apologizing. There may be a little bit of ambient noise. I'm calling from Martha's Vineyard, and I live across the street from a park where they have an annual basketball tournament complete with loudspeakers. So forgive me.
We'll take it live from Martha's Vineyard today. We're just grateful to have you join us to share some of your favorites today. And because you've traveled the world tasting foods from all corners of the earth, and this most recent book focuses on the food of the Americas and how they came to our table. Can you tell us a little bit about what makes the food from our country so different and special?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that's so interesting about the really, if you will, the origin story of American food is how it really brings three disparate parts of the world together. It brings the continents of Europe and Africa together in this hemisphere, and specifically in this, what became this country. So I think that that gives us our own specificity in terms of food, because we have not only the native peoples who were here, but we have very specific European groups that were at the inception of, you know, or at the point of first contact. That would be the Spaniards, the British, the Dutch, who had large swaths of the mid-Atlantic states under their kind of control, if you will, colonial control, and the French. And then, of course, the enslaved Africans who were brought, but who had perhaps even a disproportionately large effect on the food of this country, or what became the foundational food of this country.
How did this book come together, Braided Heritage, Recipes and Stories on the Origin of American Cuisine? How is it that this sort of became this braid of three different cultures from across the world into one delicious cookbook?
Well, the cookbook, interestingly enough, it's a book that grew out of a lecture that I gave in Natchez, Mississippi, probably about 30, maybe a decade or more ago. And in it, I was talking about the food of Natchez. And of course, there I realized, oh, wait, Native American, European American, African American. Oh my goodness, that's three. And I am a great lover of Saturday morning cartoons. What used to be Saturday morning cartoons. So I had my friends on notice, don't call. And so I would watch something called Schoolhouse Rock.
Oh, sure.
And with Schoolhouse Rock, we had, one was given a song called Three is a Magic Number in their counting thing. And so I started to think about that song, and then I started to riff on that song, and then it was like three is a magic number, you know, and I began to think about how, in terms of the foundational cultures of the United States, and really, please be careful here, because it's the foundation. It's not to say the current state, it's not to say anything that happened thereafter, but at its inception, three was that magic number, Africa, Europe, and Native America.
The foundational cultures. But as you mentioned, your friends, I couldn't help think that maybe calling your latest Braided Heritage a cookbook sells it a little bit short, because it's also telling the stories of your friends and your family. And you bring people into this book and bring them alive. Who's one of the people that really stands out that you hope that we all get to meet someday, Jessica?
Oh, well, actually, the person who stands out for me right now stands out because you won't get to meet her. She is a friend of mine who sadly died before the book was published, so she never got to see it. And in fact, her memorial is tomorrow. Her name is Abigail Rosen McGrath, and for years she did a reading of Frederick Douglass' piece, What to the Slave is the 4th of July, which she did as a public reading up here on the Vineyard every summer. And tomorrow she'll be memorialized with another reading of that. But she is in the book. She is in the book, and she is the person that I really, really am thinking about so strongly now and would love to have had people meet, because she's the anomaly. We think of African-American food, and we always, always, always think of the South.
Sure.
But Abigail, actually everybody in the book is given kind of a subtitle. Abigail's subtitle is Adventurous Daughter of the North. She was out of Boston. She had a kind of Boston upbringing. She had no real links with the southern United States. And so even though she's profoundly African-American in multiple, more ways than anyone can count, she really beats that stereotype that we have and proves that African-American food is not monolithic by any stretch of the imagination.
What dish comes to mind when you think of Abigail Rosen McGrath, Jessica?
Well, one of them that I like is sardine sandwiches.
Are they serving that at Martha's Vineyard?
I grew up in an interestingly sort of genteel blue stocking poverty. Not really poverty, but lack. And so one of the things she said, you know, when I was interviewing her was, that, you know, if they opened a can of sardines and there were four instead of three, that was like bonanza. So, you know, she had this amazing sense of humor. She was wicked. She was wonderful. She ran for over two decades something called Renaissance House that was a writer's retreat on the Vineyard. And in addition to all of that, she was Dorothy West's niece, Dorothy West being the youngest member of the Harlem Renaissance who wrote The Wedding.
Oh, wow. I also see Abigail McGrath's recipe here for salmon poached milk that's in your book, Braided Heritage, Jessica.
Yeah, salmon poached in milk. I mean, they're all very kind of mild foods, if you will. They're not really strongly spiced or, you know, seasoned as some African-American food is.
Right.
Salmon poached in milk is just a kind of wonderful, gentle way of cooking salmon. She also does something that a lot of people don't like, but that I'm quite fond of, which is liver with tomatoes. So, you know, it's a very different way of eating from, you know, cornbread and collard greens.
Absolutely. But at the same time, it's something that speaks to the American palate. I mean, sardine sandwiches is something that I could go for lunch today.
Exactly. She also has fish cakes and, you know, a creamy clam chowder. There are actually two clam chowders in the book.
Yes, there are.
Interestingly enough, Abigail's is the dairy-based creamy one from an African-American, the one that most people associate with clam chowder, whereas the traditional clam chowder from a Wampanoag friend is a clear broth clam chowder that most people are unfamiliar with, which is just clams in a clear broth. So that's all part of my, you know, my way of saying we ain't quite what we think we are.
And both of those recipes can be found in your book, Braided Heritage. Our guest is Jessica B. Harris, and her latest is what we're talking about today, bringing together the foundational cultures of Native American, European American, and African American, and the foods that they bring to the table that we can see to even today. And we want to invite you into the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 with your favorite dishes, those that have been passed down from generation to generation, and the stories you tell about the food that we enjoy, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us talk@wpr.org. We'll continue our conversation with Jessica B. Harris next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you are listening to WPR News.
Three, that's a magic number. Three. Yes, it is. It's the magic number.
De La Soul on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and we're enjoying a conversation with our guest, Jessica B. Harris, author of the cookbook Braided Heritage, Recipes and Stories on the Origin of American Cuisine, taking a look at the foundational cultures of Native American, European American, and African American, and what they bring to our table with recipes and stories of families and friends with our guest, who's joining us from Martha's Vineyard today. And Jessica, I wanted to tell you about an experience. I had the chance to try out a couple of your recipes. And so wouldn't you know, I went for the most Wisconsin recipe I could find in your book, which would have to be the enchilada suizas because of all the cheese. And I would say the recipe I enjoyed immensely. It was a revelation to me, not because of the cheeses, but because of the tomatillo sauce, the salsa, which I found, I've never made it before, and I found to be the taste of the dish.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, tomatillos are so wonderful because they're tomatoes, but they're not kind
right.
of thing. You know, they have that wonderful sort of green, slightly acidulated, tangy thing going on there that makes everything wonderful for me.
But also brings together the sort of Native American and European cultures into one single dish as the Swiss dairy joins the Native Mexican cuisine.
Exactly, exactly. And joins the Native Mexican cuisine as presented by a Texan who lives on the Mexican border. So it gets even more complicated.
But isn't that sort of the beauty of our dishes? And as you know, you go back to being a travel editor for Essence Magazine way back in the day and just, you know, seeing the entire world and tasting the entire world. And then finding what's so unique about us here in the United States is that in some way or another, you can find the entire world right here, Jessica.
Exactly. I had an aunt who was also my godmother who I think at one point had a dog that she called Heinz because he was a mutt. And so she said he was 57 varieties. That's kind of who we are. We're mutts.
And that's something to celebrate, right? I mean, because...
Absolutely. It's the beauty of us. It's the strength of us. It's the fact that, you know, pure bloodlines, well, not really. Not that many. Obviously, some Native peoples may very well have pure bloodlines, but for the rest of us, there's a whole lot of mixing going on.
Yeah, I think of my own family with my father's side, which has its Italian heritage, and my mother's side, which has its Norwegian heritage. And some of the, you know, some of the dishes that come from those and the stories that have been passed down from grandmother to granddaughter and now on to the future. And how different they are, but at the same time, how there are similar veins. Do you find this sort of... mixing of all the cultures elsewhere in the world? Is there an analogous to the United States or the Americas elsewhere that you found, Jessica?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think kind of all over the world you'll find mixing. I mean, the Italians joke that they taught the French how to cook and eat. So there's an awful lot of Italy and France. Nowadays in France, you can find a fair amount of North Africa in some of the food. Food is never sort of stagnant. It's always in movement and motion of some sort or another. And people who cook have a tendency to love to experiment.
Yes.
And to love new things as they come into the mix. And so, you get things like, I'm trying to think offhand of a recipe. Well, I don't do it in the recipe in the book, but for years I would use gari. Gari is cassava meal. Cassava is a New World tuber that has been taken to the hearts and stomachs in Africa, Western Africa particularly. And I would use a little bit of the crunch of the gari in the breading for my fried chicken.
Mm.
So you've got New World South America to Old World Africa to New World North America just in that one ingredient. So we are a mix.
How did you go about choosing the recipes for this latest book of yours, Braided Heritage?
Well, I guess first it's about how I chose the friends, because I had this idea of a braid and the people who were part of the braid, or the nationalities and places that were part of the braid, then it was like, oh, well, I'll be darned. I know somebody from all of those. So it starts out, there are 11 different people plus me, 4 from each of the braid threads. So the first person that I speak of is Julie Vanderhoop, Julianne Vanderhoop, who is a Wampanoag. Wampanoag people of first contact. Julie is a chef on Martha's Vineyard. And so I basically asked Julie and the 10 others, and then did my own, to contribute recipes that they felt represented their culture.
Hmm.
And they could be, you know, contemporary takes on old-fashioned things or something that, you know, just what they felt represented their culture on their table. And so for Julie, I get that clear broth clam chowder that we spoke about earlier.
Yeah.
I also get clam fritters. I think one of the more unusual things that I get from her is batter fried
maple leaves.
Exactly. Sugar maple leaves.
I'm gonna
just go out in your backyard and pick a maple.
Jessica B. Harris, I'm going to tell you that we gave that a try last night and had a lot of fun with it. And I would, I think it's probably a little late in the season. You should get the leaves when they're a little early so they're not too veiny and they're not too sticky. But the batter was good enough to make a little fry bread afterwards and the cranberry sauce to go together with it. Yeah, I thought that was delicious and never, I mean, we almost ate some silver maples. We had to eschew the red maples, but we did find a sugar maple tree and climb it a little bit to try to find some young leaves on it. And that beer battered maple leaf is not something I ever would have thought twice about eating. And yet it's something I probably would try again with friends because I'm sure they'd be surprised too.
Wonderful. I'm delighted. And the thing that's so funny about that was in the looking at the recipe and the trying to do a deeper dive on the recipe, I found out that it's actually also a classic dish in Japan.
What?
Yeah, so there you go.
It's funny that you make us a much smaller world in a way that brings us all together, and through food we can find these connections that maybe somehow we've lost along the way, Jessica.
Well, I think if this book does anything like that, I will be deeply gratified, because we kind of need to come together and remember that there's more that joins us than that separates us.
Yeah, you see this book, Braided Heritage, is something that may be perfect for its place and time right now?
I didn't when I was writing it, but I think that now there may be a need for it. We may, you know, we may find something in it that, that might help us.
And is it because of what food does socially and the role that food plays in how we can, you know, we can fight about it later, but first, let's eat.
Exactly, exactly. And we'll probably fight about it a little bit less if we prepare the meal together, because then it'll be like, oh, you do that that way. Well, I do that this way. A friend who was one of the early people in the idea of history of religion once gave me a wonderful word, commensality, and it is the coming together to commune over food. And I just think that that's an important, very important thing. And I think it's something that can help everybody heal. We can come together over food.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe not that Thanksgiving dinner where everybody's screaming.
or maybe if we
take a step back, yeah, and deal with the food and then the conversation and come with, you know, open hearts and minds.
We're speaking with Jessica B. Harris, historian, educator, and author. Her latest book, Braided Heritage, Recipes and Stories on the Origin of American Cuisine. And I want to invite you to our conversation as well with your stories about sharing, breaking bread at the table and coming together with recipes that have been passed down from generation or foods you love and just would like to share with everybody else if you had the chance. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can always email us, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And Jessica, I also want to, we do have one of our ear recipes on our website at wpr.org/Larry. And that is the watermelon rind pickles. And it starts with waste not, want not, that you can still use these things, like, say, sugar maple leaves when they're young in the season, but didn't think about watermelon rinds until I saw this recipe.
Well, the watermelon rind recipe is actually something that I remember from my maternal grandmother, who grew up with a kind of Virginia-style cooking. And when you talk about Virginia-style cooking and African-Americans, we think of Edna Lewis. And the whole idea of roasts, you know, Sunday roasts and things like that, again, not the classic, you know, hog maws and stuff that people might connect with African Americans, but something a little bit different. And the idea of pickles or pickle something to go with the roasts as kind of a condiment is something my grandmother was very much a partisan of. Now, the thing that's interesting is that it really is always about the rind. So it is that, not the pink part or the yellow part, but that white part that then becomes slightly translucent as it's pickled and takes on the flavors of, you know, the vinegar, the sugar, the cinnamon, a little pinch of clove and allspice, so that you've got all of those kind of almost apple pie seasonings that are going into what is really kind of a syrup. And that's what pickles the watermelon rind. They are really good. They're particularly good. I used to do them as, I still do occasionally, but not as often, as a sort of little cocktail nibble, a piece of bacon wrapped around a watermelon rind pickle.
Okay.
And if you're too lazy to pickle them yourselves, you can buy them online.
Well, it's not a complicated process. It may just take some time.
No, it's not, but it does take a minute.
Yeah. I tried your pickled beets, went down to the farmer's market this week, and your pickled beets recipe is very simple, but it was that touch, as you mentioned, with the watermelon rind pickles. It's that touch of cloves that really made it stand out, that made it, you know, punch, that took away some of the earthiness of the beets and gave it another dimension of flavor altogether.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the tricks is, I've always said to people, African-American food, and those recipes are from the African-American chapter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that African-American food is not always highly seasoned. I mean, a lot of people go, oh, it's hot, it's spicy, it's just pepper. But they're well-seasoned. It's the seasoning mixes. It's the pinch of things people may not think of, but that make all the difference in the world.
The tart of the vinegar, the sweetness of the sugar, and then the spice of the clove and how that brings the beet to life, or I imagine the watermelon rind to life. Yes, very flavorful.
Absolutely. And then the other thing about the watermelon rind pickles and the whole waste not, want not thing is, back in the, during the Depression, I unfortunately forgotten her name, but there was a woman in New York City who would go and collect at, you know, grocery stores or wherever watermelons were being consumed, the rinds. You know, it was trash. You know, we talk about food waste.
Right.
This is a great no food waste recipe. But, you know, she would collect them, pickle them, and then sell the pickles to make money. Interestingly, the person who wrote the second African-American cookbook, which was published in 1881 and called What Mrs. Fisher Knows About Old Southern Cooking, Mrs. Fisher, Abby Fisher, was someone who was known for her pickles. So it was something that African-Americans did and did well.
What would you say in the Native American section of the book, what was it that the natives brought to the table that they did so well that has a lasting impact on our cuisine today?
Well, I think there we've got an amazing amount of ingredients.
Huh.
Think of the things that we would not have had had it not been for Native Americans. Certainly not so much the things like samp.
Yeah.
Samp being corn. Corn is classically Native American. You know, part of the Three Sisters, those Three Sisters, corn, beans, and squash. The young plants were shaded by the squash leaves, which allowed the soil to retain moisture. The prickly stems of the squash plants kept the critters from nibbling at the corn and beans. The beans could twist around the corn stalks. And the corn, of course, was mother corn. So they all grew in sort of symbiotic harmony. They were even known popularly as the Three Sisters.
Three is a magic number, Jessica.
And there we are again. Three is a magic number, absolutely. So, I mean, so we get those, the squash and the corn and the beans all being New World ingredients. Think about the classic Southern succotash.
Yes. Also in your book.
Derived from a Narragansett word. So we've got all of that. The Three Sisters are sometimes also known as the Iroquois and Triad. Again, the three. So, you know, we've got a lot of stuff. And then, of course, the bounty that was here. We've got things like the clams that turn up so much on the East Coast. The clam fritters that are in the Wampanoag chapter, a clam pie in the Shinnecock chapter, just, you know, even a clam chowder made by the Europeans with the dairy in the Abigail McGrath chapter, the African-American chapter. All of that is part of the bounty that becomes a part of the American braid.
Jessica B. Harris, I find it interesting that you mentioned the summer southern succotash as having Native American roots, and yet the recipe shows up in your African-American section of Braided Heritage.
Well, the summer southern succotash uses okra.
Aha!
Takes it from the European or from the Native American and does, again, a riff on it. It adds another ingredient that then changes it somewhat. It is not just the corn, beans, and squash that would have been the traditional succotash. It is the okra that is from Africa. It's got onions that are from Europe, Asia, Eurasia, and tomatoes that are New World. So you got everybody going on in there.
What's Jessica B. Harris got cooking up for the 4th of July holiday?
I'll be visiting friends.
They'll be cooking for you.
Exactly.
That's the way you do it. As you look back at the work that you've put into this book, what are you hoping that folks get out of Braided Heritage, Jessica?
A whole lot of good meals.
Yeah.
And maybe some thoughts about the country and its origins. But the meals, most importantly and above all, you know, how to think about, you know, putting food together, some new riffs on maybe some old foods. Yep. The idea, you know, people might have clams. If you've got clams, you've always had clam chowder, maybe try a clam pie. There is a strawberry shortcake in the Native American chapter under the Shinnecocks. It's strawberry season a lot of places, so it's a good time to try that shortcake, which is a little bit different from traditional shortcakes just because of the shortcake that is so delicious. You know, so many different ways of looking at things. My friend Charlotte Lyons, who is in the African American chapter, is actually someone who was for 25 years the food editor of Ebony. And as such, when I got to the African American chapter, because I didn't want to get into the very, very sticky wicket of who comes from where, I went with themes. So the theme we've already talked about was Abigail Rosen McGrath, who was a child of the North. Whereas Lenny Sorensen, who is also in that chapter, is someone who represented migration. Lenny is a child of the Great Migration in that her father and stepfather both were from Louisiana, but they followed the migratory, if you will, pattern of many Louisianans and ended up in Los Angeles. So she represents migration with some southern Louisiana and Texas recipes as they were inflected in Los Angeles. And then Charlotte, that I was mentioning before I got off on that professorial tangent, Charlotte, as food editor, I tasked with taking traditional recipes like the pickled beets that you talked about earlier, and then doing, if you will, a riff on those pickled beets. And so she comes up with another salad, a beet salad using golden beets that is more contemporary. So we have all of those different kinds of things in the mix.
I just wanted to share with you that I tried the roasted golden beet salad as well, because the golden beets, I did not expect them to be there, but we're at the farmer's market this week also. And it gave it a completely different, it was a sweet beet, and I did not see that coming. And it also has a citrus dressing that is both orange and lemon, with a little bit of orange zest in there as well, with some oil and a shallot that made it for a little bit of a kick. That was a completely different beet experience. I'm not the biggest beet fan, but Jessica B. Harris, your book has sold me on them in one degree or another, from the pickled beets to the roasted golden beet salad, which I found very much a surprise in its sweetness.
Yeah. Well, that's the genius of Charlotte Lyons, is that she comes up with things that are tasty and innovative.
Yeah.
I mean, traditional fried catfish, yeah, you would expect it. But catfish tacos, you might not expect. So it was kind of a way of putting things together in new ways.
Well, that was one on my list that I just haven't gotten to yet, Jessica, but I am very curious, as a kid who grew up on a lot of catfish and who obviously, like anybody else, loves Taco Tuesday, I am very curious about how those two things come together.
Oh, well, I think you'll enjoy the taste.
I've enjoyed everything else so far. And you mentioned the strawberry shortcake from the Native American section of your book, Braided Heritage, Jessica B. Harris. But what are some of the other desserts that we find in there?
Well, I mean, Charlotte is, I am not a baker. Let me start by saying that. So the desserts are really coming from my friends who are masters and mistresses of that. I am, you know, I don't know which side of the brain it is, but it is the improvisational, innovative one, but that's me. I, you know, recipes are sometimes my bugaboo. But we've got beignet, the classic New Orleans yeasted fritter, you know, that is, you know, everybody in New Orleans goes and has them at Café du Monde, and they are, you know, something that you don't go to New Orleans and not have. But we also have, in the New Orleans chapter, kala. Kala is a rice fritter. And so we've got the European fritter, the beignet, and then the kala, which is a fritter that comes from a recipe from a friend of mine who is actually, here's a New Orleans story, he is a direct descendant of the first surviving male child born in the French colonies. Now, people in New Orleans know their lineage unto the nanosecond, and that's why we know about the Pope. But what happens is that when I asked him, oh, you're a direct descendant of the first male child born, and he said, no, I'm not. I'm a direct descendant of the second male child born in the colonies. The first male child dies. So out of his family, there was, you know, handwritten recipes and recipe cards and recipes that have been transcribed and passed down over the generations. But one of them is from a woman named Poupon d'Antilly, and she is probably, she may have been enslaved, she might have been a free person of color, but she worked for his family. And it is her recipe for kala, the rice fritter, that he gives. So we've got both the wheat fritter, the beignet, and the rice fritter. So we've got all of them.
Just part of the book, Braided Heritage, from our guest, Jessica B. Harris, and I want to invite you to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. If you have a story about a dish that you'd like to share or a recipe that you wish everybody could taste, what would yours be? You can also email us, talk@WPR.org. Our conversation with Jessica B. Harris continues. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News.
In the past, in the present, in the future, faith and hope and charity, in the heart, in the brain, in the body, will give you three. It's a magic number. Takes 3 days.
Blind Melon on the Larry Miller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry today. And coming up after noon, we'll hear from a Wisconsinite who sold her house, moved into a truck, and traveled the world. And we'll find out how she did it, and her favorite memories from years spent on the road. I understand she's back on the road. We'll find out where after noon. But right now, our guest is Jessica B. Harris, educator, historian, and author, who has authored, edited, or translated 17 books, including High on the Hog, which was adapted into a Netflix docuseries. Her most recent, we're talking about it now, Braided Heritage, Recipes and Stories on the Origin of American Cuisine. And Jessica, you talked about Lou Costa and how his family story helped bring you the story of kalas, which is the recipe in your book. What about the Jessica B. Harris family story and how that led you to where you are today?
Oh, well, that's, how much time do we have?
About 12 minutes.
I am sort of an outlander in that I'm an only child. And so I was in the kitchen when my mother was in the kitchen. I was blessed with having a mother who not only was an extraordinarily good cook, but who was also trained as a dietitian. My mother actually had a better palate than I do, or than I ever will in a lifetime. She could, taste the mace in the apple pie and tell you what it was, or, oh my goodness, they put a little touch of cardamom in something. She had that kind of a palate and that kind of a taste, you know, range. So I grew up eating extraordinarily well. My parents were aspirational black folks. And I was an only child. I was also a late child. My mother had what, back when I was born, was considered to be a geriatric pregnancy. She was 35 when I was born. So they had kind of had a lot of fun and sown many wild oats before I got here. And so when I got here, they just kind of poured all of their aspirations and all of their attention and affection into me. And as a result, I got, an extraordinary upbringing. I was the first non-UN-connected child to go to the United Nations International School. And that's important because it means from early on, I was acquainted, if you will, with the tastes of the world. One of my oldest friends is a Shivite Brahmin from Madras, now Chennai, India. Another person who calls me first friend lives in Wales. I had friends from, back in nursery school, the legend is that, or the Jessica, probably apocryphal story is that my best friend was from Egypt and named Samir, and I didn't speak a word of Arabic, and he didn't speak a word of English, but we kind of grunted and smiled and pointed, and we're fast friends. So all of that, I think, now informs not just my taste, but also how I have an ability to communicate with people in cultures that are not my own. And I think that that is one of the things that has enabled me to write about food the way I write about food, but equally to speak to people from other cultures.
Yeah, and what is it that translates across cultures as you found, Jessica?
Oh, I mean, I think our humanity is universal.
Yeah.
I can reference, I went to China for the first time in 2019.
Hmm.
And, yeah, 2019, and was surprised. Because after, I live in New York City when I'm not on the vineyard, but flying from New York, I think I spoke in Seattle, and then from Seattle across the Pacific to land in Beijing in the middle of, I don't know if it was night or day, but it was a long time for me. And I was hungry, so when I got to the hotel, I went to the restaurant, which was getting ready to close, and I sat down and had my first meal in China. Well, it was barbecue and okra. It was barbecued duck and okra, just plain steamed okra. And for dessert, I had some pieces of watermelon. So I had okra, barbecue, and watermelon, totally unintended, but in China as absolutely a Chinese meal. Nobody thought I was coming and made a special dish for me. So I say that to say that we are on the plate connected in so many ways. In so many ways we don't know if we don't travel.
Ah, haha. So are there still places you'd like to go? Are there still things on your itinerary, Jessica B. Harris, that you are looking to get to?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I have been to the Indian subcontinent, want to go back. If there were world enough and time, I'd like to investigate the African diaspora as it moves east, as opposed to as it moved west. I'd like to know South America better. Basically, I'm going to keep traveling until they stop carrying me on and off planet.
Well, what is it that brings you back? What's it like to, go from China and have a meal that could be from back home, but then to get back home again?
Well, I mean, I think what brings me back home is just that. It is home.
Yeah.
It is home, and home is where, for me, home is where the books are. Home is where the cats are. Home is where the kitchen is, and home is where, I can indulge in things like my mom's fried chicken or leg of lamb or watermelon rind pickles. Home is where, I'm in the kitchen doing what I want.
I don't think we got to any of them here, but there are a couple of drinks that are mentioned in your book, Braided Heritage. And Jessica, I'm very curious about the Bloody Mary. What are the drinks that stand out for you that tie our Braided Heritage together?
Well, I don't know if it ties our Braided Heritage together, but certainly there is a drink called Mr. Good Daddy.
Yeah.
Mr. Good Daddy is a drink that is kind of in honor of a friend of my parents. Her name was Grace Bales, and if people know of Flo Kennedy, who was an activist for women's rights, very outspoken, she was one of the Kennedy sisters. And Grace was a tall lady with a booming bass voice who was also teetotal. So whenever she would go somewhere, she would always say, "Oh, I know you have some Mr. Good Daddy for me. Please bring me a glass of Mr. Good Daddy." And Mr. Good Daddy was basically any non-alcoholic punch that could be served. So I've done a punch called Mr. Good Daddy in honor of Grace Bale.
Well, and again, it seems like something that would be simple enough for anybody to make, but also the tastes, you got to probably try it to believe it. A grape juice, pink lemonade, ginger ale, put it all together, and what do you get? You can call it Mr. Good Daddy. Yeah.
And that was how it worked. There's also what I call a bluff bloody. Basically, I call it a bluff bloody because I serve it up here in on the vineyard. And what I do is I prepare the vodka. And the vodka, I have the old-fashioned, you know, iced tea containers with a spigot on the bottom and, you know, a big old glass that you could do, I don't know, sun tea in or something like that. And I fill it with bell peppers, with two or three jalapenos and one habanero, all of them pricked.
Ooh.
And I fill it then with what the guy at the liquor store on the vineyard used to call cost-effective vodka.
Plastic bottle vodka.
Cost-effective, yeah. So my iced tea container takes a couple of gallon bottles of the vodka, and I let it sit.
For how long?
You get a vodka that is flavored with the bell pepper, which gives it its own faint sort of greenish bell peppery taste.
Yeah.
And then you get the kick of the jalapeno, which is a mild kick, and then you get the stronger kick of the habanero. And if you, you know, make your usual Bloody Mary with your usual mix, you've got something quite different.
You're infusing your own vodka here, Jessica. That is something that people pay good money for, but you get to set the taste for yourself. How long do you usually let that sit?
As long as I can wait.
So it says in your book about 2 weeks, but I'm taking it that means that's about as long as you can wait.
Yeah, I mean, you can keep it. Actually, last summer I left the island in a hurry, and I didn't empty the vodka container. And usually I have a friend who will come and do that. But she left it, so I've got some, you know.
Hello.
About 8 months vodka.
Well.
That's pretty darn good.
With that, I would imagine we would wish you a very happy 4th of July holiday. And a big thank you for joining us on our show today, Jessica B. Harris. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much, Lee. And when I have the bluff bloody, I'll raise the glass to you.
And when I have some Mr. Good Daddy, I will do the same. Very much appreciate the fun hour. Jessica B. Harris, educator, historian, and author. She has authored, edited, or translated 17 books now, including her very latest, Braided Heritage. Seek it out today. Braided Heritage, recipes and stories on the origin of American cuisine. Really appreciated some of those recipes, and I hope you get a chance to try some of them yourself. And coming up in the next hour, we will travel the world with a woman from Waterford who dropped it all, put her dog in the car, and went to see where she, as far as she could go. What's it like to be without deadlines and destinations? We'll hear her story and perhaps a few travel stories of yours as well. When we continue here on the Larry Mueller Show, I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. We all got things that hang.
make us cool, things that make us whack, things that make us mad, things we wish we never had done. But they're just the things that make us real, not the master guide where we go from here. The road twists and braids like hair until we all get there.
Walking in the race of life, looking for my own pace. Not always wanting to, but I have to. Sometimes feeling like I'm...
Good afternoon, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry today, and our next guest hates pants, but loves to travel the world. Dropped it all here in Wisconsin to go see over 12 countries now across two continents, and her stories have been documented on her travel blog, Hi from Ashley, also on her YouTube channel and Instagram. As we talk with our guest, Ashley Kay, today, would love to hear about your travels and where they've taken you, what you've seen, what you've learned, and what stays with you long after you've returned home. Call us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can always email talk at WPR.org. And Ashley Kay, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm very curious about your life and would love to live vicariously through you for the next hour if I could. So where are we talking to you from today?
I am calling in from Bermuda today.
Ah, what's it like where you are?
Hot and humid. Oh, just the way I like it.
I was going to say, that's kind of the way it is here in Wisconsin today.
Yeah, but this is like oceanside.
So it's a wet heat.
Yeah, but it's lovely.
Take us back from when this all started. Who was Ashley Kay and what was her life like before you hit the road?
Oh, how far back do you want to go?
How did it start?
Honestly, it's just a series of life events that kind of shaped my life in different ways. Some small, some big. My dad passed away when I was 27, and I spent the next year just listening to family and friends around the U.S. call and share stories about his wild, crazy, free life. Mm. And that really planted the seed, like, hey, maybe you need to start living life a little bit. So started working extra hard, got a consulting job, saving everything. Went scuba diving, got certified in Honduras. I met a guy who was a few years younger than me, but he was traveling around the world without ever stepping foot on a plane. He was a civil engineer from Austria, and went through a conversation with him, everything. He was couch surfing, hitchhiking. He crossed the Atlantic on a cargo ship, lived very cheaply, and just kind of asked him, like, okay, obviously, I would travel a little bit differently, but what's the worst of the worst? I was prepared for him to like share some terrible experience, couch surfing or something like that. And his response was just that I didn't start sooner because it's so much easier and cheaper than you could ever believe. And I was like, okay, that kind of sealed the deal for me. I went home, worked twice as hard for about 4 years, saved enough money and just quit.
What kind of planning went into hitting the road?
Honestly, not much.
Wow.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a different way. Like, I'm used to be a Excel spreadsheet girly. Everything was planned down to the minute.
I know the type, yes.
Yes, and now, I mean, my life is, the plan is there's no plan. I only have two rules, don't die and don't get arrested.
Wow.
And that's it. Just kind of figure it out as you go. I have a general outline, I guess. I'd live by a general outline. Maybe this month I'll be in this country and next month I'll be in that country. Other than that, I just figure out everything as I go. I honestly don't do a ton of research as to like, what are the top 10 best destinations or this or that. I look for photography places on maps. I'm obsessed with maps. So I have thousands of places on maps. I'm like, okay, let's just go there, check it out, and see what happens.
It sounds like the proverbial throwing a dart at a map somewhere and seeing where it lands and heading that in that direction.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. It's an adventure.
Ashley, as somebody who, you know, came from the world of spreadsheets, which I can totally relate to, organize and order, it makes sense to me. Is there anxiety when you take that organization and order away?
In the beginning, there was.
Yeah.
My first destination that I went to was French Polynesia. So I landed in Tahiti with no real plan, except I was going to be there for 3 months. I wanted to go scuba diving with sharks and stingrays, stuff like this. And I spent the first 3 weeks with a friend of mine who was sailing there. And he's like, I was like, we should go here. We should go there. Let's check out this beach. I want to try this restaurant. He's like, you know, you really need to learn how to do nothing. I was like, I don't, like, I just quit my career. I was working 80 to 100 hours a week. I don't know how to do nothing.
Right.
Like, I have to go and do something. It took me about a month to deprogram, and now I'm professional at doing nothing. It's my favorite thing to do.
You're good at it. You've gotten good at it.
Yes.
So,
expert level.
When did your travel start? Was it, what year was that?
I left the U.S. Thanksgiving of 2019.
At the end of 2019. And
yeah,
how many?
About 5.5 years.
How far have you gone since then? I mean, how many places have you been, would you say, ballpark?
As far as countries?
Sure.
I probably 12, 14, 18,
wow.
Maybe. Like somewhere between 18 and 25. I don't keep track exactly because I'm a slow traveler. So I try to stay 90 days, 3 months is usually the limit for a U.S. passport, like visa free. Some countries like Bermuda, Mexico, I think Colombia, you get 6 months. So I try to stay as long as I can.
And how long have you been in Bermuda now? And how long do you intend to stay?
I got to Bermuda about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
It's a secret, so don't tell anybody. but I will be here hopefully for all of summer and into September. It would be fantastic.
How do you make it work financially? I mean, I understand, you know, you don't have to be going to the restaurants or spending money, but how do you make ends meet while out there on the road?
Well, just, you know, being financially responsible is a real thing. Being financially irresponsible is a real thing. For the first 3 years, I traveled off of savings.
Yeah.
So by the time I left in 2019, I had, I think it was like $37,000 saved
up. That's not a lot. Yeah.
No, it's not a lot at all. But my average expenses, including like property taxes in Wisconsin, electric bill, quarterly taxes, were $12,000 a year.
Sure.
So when you are traveling full time on one-way tickets, things become much cheaper. It's, you're not flying back and forth. I'm not staying at the Ritz. I'm not going out to fancy restaurants all of the time. But it was really, really cheap, to be honest. And I still did a little bit of consulting the first year. So I had a little bit of income, nothing crazy. And then after I ran out of money, I came home and was just like, okay, I think I'm ready for the next chapter of my life. I don't really think I want to live in Wisconsin anymore. I love being on an island, love looking at the ocean, and I want to keep traveling. So I sold my childhood house and I put 30 into long-term investments, 30 into a savings account, and then 30% into building and traveling for the next 2 years.
How long ago is
that? And now, the house sale?
Yeah.
March of 2023.
Okay. Yeah, so that was about 2 years ago now.
Yep. So I'm nearing the end. The savings is getting really slim, which makes me mildly uncomfortable because the rest of the money is like, don't look at it. Don't touch it. Yeah. It doesn't exist. That's for future Ashley when I want to buy a house again somewhere in the world. So I will have to get a job again at some point after I finish this chapter, overlanding to the end of the earth. But you've got a
travel blog, hifromashley.com. You have a YouTube channel. Do you get sponsorships or are there other channels of income that you can find while traveling?
I don't do any sponsorships or any like product promotion, brand deal type of stuff because honestly, it's really difficult. I'm in a new country sometimes every month or every 3 months. Shipping stuff to South America is really difficult. And honestly, the brands want you to be in the United States and promoting. Like, it's just not realistic for them to be able to ship a product to me and have me review it and post it within 11 days. It won't even be out of the port in 11 days. So my focus this year is kind of catching up on the video backlog for YouTube. And I actually make a lot of money on TikTok.
Oh, okay. So there is a revenue stream from being able to travel the world and show people who would like to live vicariously through you like myself.
Oh, for sure. And if I had a little bit more time to actually sit down and edit videos 40 hours a week, oof, I would definitely be making a lot more money on social media than I do. But
and yet, that would kind of take away from the purpose of your travels to begin with, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
I could totally understand that. Like, you could actually monetize this if you made it a full-time job, but that's the thing you left in the first place, so why would you go do that?
Exactly. A lot of content creators that are travel-based, I mean, they will fly to France or Italy, wherever they're traveling, capture all of the content, and then as soon as they come back into the U.S., and their algorithms are U.S.-based, Facebook and Instagram, they know where you're posting from. So once your socials have reset to the U.S., then they will post everything, and content is pushed more in the United States. So
isn't that
that's where the monetization is. Yeah, it is definitely.
And interesting as well that you'd have to learn that as part of your travels is like, well, I'd have to be back in the United States to post this in order to monetize this. Wow, that's a lot to think about, Ashley.
There's a lot of pieces.
Yeah.
YouTube and TikTok, I can post from anywhere in the world. It's not as, how do I say that? Like slowed down in the algorithm. The TikTok is a geo-based app, but Facebook and Instagram are, every time I change a country, think my algorithm, everything changes and my post will not like be shown. It's very strange. But
and the reason I asked about sponsorship, Ashley, is because your camper truck has kind of become part of the character on your social media posts and your blog.
Yeah.
Tell us about this camper truck.
Honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, I can tell.
Little bit obsessed. Honestly, that wasn't planned either. I knew at some point I wanted to do some type of van life around the United States. And I wanted to do that with my dog, keep traveling. So everything happens for a reason. I had the perfect van picked out. It was like an F-350. The guy was from Vermont. He had redone everything mechanical, four-wheel drive, Dana 60. Everything was coated. Everything a man would do for four-wheel drive off-roading, he did it. And I was like, okay, this is what I want. I stayed in touch with him for 6 months and his van sold on Sunday morning and I got a cash offer on my house Monday morning.
Oh,
I was like, okay, it's just not meant to be. New plan. 2 days later, a couple They are from Oregon, I believe. They are traveling around the world in the same type of setup that I have. They had sent me a message, followed me on Instagram. They were traveling through Africa or planning their travels through Africa. And I was like, this is weird. Like, what are these guys up to? And I looked at their page. What is this truck and camper situation? Overlanding? What is overlanding? I need to go down the YouTube rabbit hole. What is this? Obviously, it's four-wheel drive. Okay. So within a week, I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to get a Toyota Tacoma. I need a four-wheel drive, six-foot bed. I need to start looking to buy this. And I need to get a camper and all of these pieces because I just accepted a cash offer on my house. And in 30 days, I'm going to be homeless. So let's go.
And that Toyota Tacoma has traveled with you in ways I wouldn't think possible because it's gone and it's traveled where there have been no roads. Is it with you in Bermuda today?
No.
Okay.
It's stored in Argentina for winter.
Okay. Ashley,
it definitely would not fit on the roads here in Bermuda.
Ashley Kay is our guest, author of the travel blog, Hi from Ashley, and you can find her on all the socials, but you may have to do some digging because of the algorithm and the fact that she's joining us from Bermuda afternoon after dropping everything here in Wisconsin and traveling the world, which she has been around and then some since 2019. Do you have questions about her experiences or would like to share one of your own? We welcome you to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, talk@WPR.org. We'll continue with our guest, Ashley. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Good afternoon. And just a reminder, if you miss part of our show or want to hear any of it again, you can always go to our archives at WPR.org/Larry to hear podcasts of our previous broadcasts. And as well, WPR.org/Larry is where you'll find a link to our guest's travel blog, HiFromAshley.com. Ashley Kay, our guest. She's been traveling the world after leaving Wisconsin, getting in a Toyota Tacoma and seeing where it takes her without deadlines, without destinations, and seeing the world. And Ashley, you'd mentioned going down a rabbit hole, figuring out what overlanding is. And I did not, I do not know what overlanding is. When you were looking for your car to take on your travels with you, what is overlanding?
Overlanding is just traveling by some type of vehicle, where you are sleeping, eating, crossing borders. It's a hot debate in the overlanding world whether or not international travel is required in the definition of overlanding. But I kind of lean towards, experiencing other cultures is part of overlanding because it is a method of travel. And if you're just traveling from your local town bar to your grocery store, that doesn't really count.
That would make me an overlander, which I am not yet. Yeah. But it sounds like you've come across others like you who are overlanders. Is this a larger subculture than perhaps those of us with 9-to-5 jobs would guess?
Yeah, I would say I'm quite shocked on how many people are overlanding. It's definitely more popular in Australia, Europeans, specifically Germans, Dutch, French, and then Latinos overland through Latin America a lot, especially like there's a whole moto adventure crew who are, I guess, more or less overlanding as well, but different methods. And then it's finally making its way to the United States. So you'll see a few people from the U.S. on the road, but it's more Europeans that I run into.
And when overlanders get together to talk, what is it that you find yourselves most often talking about, Ashley?
Food, people, good places to camp, like the favorite experiences. I will say there is a big difference on topics outside of the U.S. So in the U.S., everybody's talking about gear, what to buy. And outside the US, it's more about the experiences, which is quite funny sometimes.
Are there other discussions about how to make it work financially? Because that's the thing, like, is somebody going back to the spreadsheet culture or mindset as like, well, how do I make this work? How can I make this dollar stretch? Do you find out how other people are doing it and have the means to get it done?
I don't. I honestly don't ask people what they do for work. It's something that I noticed when I first started traveling. The second that you meet somebody from the United States, they're often asking you, what do you do for work, before they even ask what your name is. And that's just not the case in other cultures. Like, who you are as a person, your hobbies, your passions define you more than your career, which was something that I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have to like switch and think a little bit differently. So unless people offer what they do for work, I don't ask. I don't go out of my way to ask. If there are overlanders who are funding their trips from sponsors or YouTube, you know it because it's all over their rig. Like, they have stickers advertising it.
Oh, sure.
And then it's cool to kind of like chat with them. So what are you doing? What's your favorite part? Like, filming? How do you manage that? Because it's a lot of work. So they will often overland part-time and then stay in hostels or hotels part-time. And people who do work, they will overland for 6 months and then go back to work for 6 months.
Okay.
So yeah, it's kind of all over the place. But most people that I run into that are doing the Pan American Highway, they are not living this way. This is a once in a lifetime trip that they're doing. Oh. And they're often trying to do the entire trip in less than 6 months.
Whoa. I mean, when you talk about the entire trip of the Pan American Highway, what does that entail? From where to where?
This sounds really bad because I don't actually know where it starts, but it's somewhere in Alaska.
Okay.
And then it ends in Ushuaia, Argentina.
Wow.
In total, it's about 19,000 miles. Yeah. And you have to ship across the Darien Gap. So that's at least 2 to 3 weeks. So if you're planning this trip in less than 6 months, just the shipping and the transport and everything, you're basically doing the whole trip in 5 months, which sounds awful to me. You're just driving and filling up your gas tank.
Yeah, that's not something that you put on your radar as something you'd like to accomplish?
No, I am a slow traveler. Yeah. I like to see as much as possible. So, for example, I bought this truck with 5 miles on it. Five single miles, and I haven't finished the journey yet, and my truck is like just about to hit 36,000 miles.
Wow.
So I've gone way out of my way, and I didn't even start from Alaska. Like, I haven't even done any of that yet. So
have you had to ship your Toyota Tacoma? And if so, what is that process like, and how much does that set you back thereabouts?
Yeah, so I did have to ship from Panama to Colombia. That was one of the biggest reasons why I wanted to get a Toyota Tacoma with this camper setup. So the roof of my camper is down when I'm driving, mm-hmm. and that size fits inside of a shipping container, and you can split a shipping container with another traveler. And each container costs about $4,400, so $2,200 per vehicle. And yeah, pretty easy, pretty stressful. Like, it's not all easy breezy. It was a very stressful experience. And like, no, don't drop my truck in the ocean, please.
How long were you?
Yeah. My home.
Yes, that's your house. So how long were you without your house, and what did you do in the meantime without it?
The total shipping time for me took 16 days. Ooh. There was a couple of delays that happened, but I was in Panama for the beginning and then flew to Colombia and stayed in Cartagena with my dog. And that was pretty stressful, being a solo traveler with my dog. Cartagena is not super pet friendly. dogs are illegal to go in Ubers in Colombia. Some drivers will say, yes, no problem. But it was pretty stressful. It was intense because every day you're checking. And when am I going to get my truck back? Okay, it's a delay. And yeah, but everything ends up in the end all good. And you'll get your home and get to go.
I am sorry about your loss.
Thank you.
Yeah, Porter has passed away. And it was such a, again, like your Tacoma, Porter was the main character in your travels from the outset. And now it's just you solo. What's that like for you?
Honestly, it was awful. I feel like I'm already going to cry because I'm not over it. It's been only like 11 months. Yeah. And root is it's awful. He was my best friend, like my little son. And honestly, I knew he was not going to be part of the journey at some point before I even left, before I even bought the truck. So
was he older to begin with? I mean,
yeah, he was.
Seemed like a wise man.
Yeah, he was honestly the best. He never barked. He loved food. He loved people. Super good with kids. So
he was good with cows.
He was excellent to travel.
You've got a YouTube video of Porter with the cows, and it's just like he's looking at you, and the cows are looking at him, and it's just perfect. So I was kind of I share your sadness, and I'm so sorry for your loss, and I think it would be a little bit lonelier out there wherever you are without him, but at the same time. I think they always kind of in some way stay with us in those memories and those little laughs that we get because of them.
Yeah, 100%. And he was a major motivator for this whole adventure. I mean,
yeah,
I knew these were going to be his last years. So I was like, okay, like we're going to go be outside, live your best life for him. He was part black lab, so absolutely just loved to be outside 24/7. There were nights I would have to pick him up off of the ground outside and carry him into the camper. He's like, I just want to be outside. I love it here. And yeah, he was a little stinker. He made friends everywhere he went because he was motivated by food. So many incredible memories.
Ashley, you gave him the largest dog park in the world. There could be no greater gift for a black lab than to be able to hit the road with you and be home wherever you land. So I just think that's a great gift for the both of you. Did Porter's death change? Pause you in your tracks? How did you start thinking about next steps or moving forward after that loss?
Oh yeah, I took a 4-month pause. So he passed away in Colombia, and so I left my truck there, and I don't even remember exactly where I went to. I think I came back to Wisconsin for 2 weeks, spent some time with family, friends, and then I came to Bermuda. And I was in Bermuda for about 3 months, just kind of hiding out, healing, seeing some friends, but yeah, trying to figure out the next chapter because it's terrible, it's sad, but I have to keep moving forward. Yeah. I have to keep swimming, I have to keep moving forward. Yeah. And the reality is, traveling by yourself with a dog is a lot of work. There are a lot of places that you can't go. You can't camp. I mean, every time I go into a grocery store, I would have to leave the air conditioner on, the truck running with the windows up, locked. And that could be anywhere from 1 to 2 hours. Crossing borders, the same thing. Sometimes my truck is running for 5 hours. It's 100 degrees out and the air conditioning is on because he can't go inside. So there's a lot of stuff that was very challenging overlanding with a dog by yourself, and a lot of places I couldn't go. I couldn't stay at some of the coolest Airbnb listings that I found. It's no pets allowed. So as terrible as it sounds, I have all of my freedoms back.
Yeah.
So
it's a different experience going forward. Right. But you know, it's, you go it alone now, where you used to have your best friend by your side and always worth it to a point. But now this, your travels go on. And I think that's exciting. And when I watch your videos, I'm kind of think about how important Porter was. But at the same time, you write about on your travel blog, Hi From Ashley, some of the challenges with your dog. You mentioned it in Colombia. And as we started the conversation and you were thinking about dropping everything and hitting the road, you talked to that engineer and you asked him what the worst of the worst was for him. And he had said to you, I just wish I'd done it sooner. For Ashley K, what's the worst of the worst been so far for you? And I probably think I know the answer.
I mean, aside from Porter passing.
Yeah. Which would have been my guess.
That's definitely the worst of the worst so far, but that was going to happen no matter what. Mm. Whether we were traveling or just living in Wisconsin still. The worst of the worst when it comes to travel, aside from Porter passing, I don't think that I have any award-winning answer. I would say just figure out a little piece of the puzzle that you want to do and just go and do it. Because everything else is figure-outable and you don't have to have all of the gear. You don't have to have every single piece of the puzzle. Just go. Just start. Just go.
Will you find what you're looking for along the way? I mean, when you come across different cultures and different peoples, do you find them as obstructions, or are they part of the missing pieces that you thought you might need before you left in the first place?
That's a good question. I don't ever really feel like I'm looking for anything. I go to every country with no expectations. I'm always excited to try the food, see what type of culture I'm going to experience. Other than that, I feel like I'm just always looking to learn.
When it comes to the food, Ashley, what's the best of the best you've come across, or perhaps the most surprising that you never would have thought?
Oh, that's a long list.
Oh.
So Peruvian food, hands down, some of the best food in the entire world. I did not have a single bad meal in Peru, even in the middle of nowhere, in the mountains. Absolutely delicious food everywhere. Venezuelan food, I absolutely love. Mexican food, of course. The food in Guatemala, when you get into like the Mayan communities, is really beautiful. And the connection to their culture, their heritage, was really special to learn about. French Polynesia, like Poisson Cru, is like melt in your mouth. The best, it's their own twist on ceviche. Ooh. But absolutely the best in the world.
So if I were going to go to Peru, what would you recommend I eat?
Lomo saltado is probably the most popular, but I like the pollo saltado, which is the chicken version, a little bit better.
Chicken and what?
Anything. It's like a immersion between Asian and Latino cooking. So yeah, the sauces feel very Asian, and then the cooking style is Peruvian. Absolutely delicious. I mean, you can order anything in Peru and it's going to be delicious.
You're in Bermuda now.
Maybe you want to try the guinea pig, but I'm not.
I didn't. You did not. Okay, no, maybe pass on that.
I couldn't do it.
Everything else was delicious. You're in Bermuda now. What are you dining on, and what do you look forward to eating?
So Bermuda's most famous debate on island is who has the best fish sandwich.
Ooh.
So that's a hot topic. I have two favorite places. And then a lot of seafood. I'm trying to eat healthy for the summer. So I'm trying to rest, relax, edit all my photos and videos, but also have a hot girl summer. So I need to be conscious of what I'm eating. Yeah.
Hot girl summer with fish sandwiches is a win-win in my book.
And maybe a few margaritas.
Are you, do you speak multiple languages? Do you find language to be a barrier wherever you go?
I speak a decent amount of Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And I speak a very, 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 very limited amount of French. I've forgotten more French than I've learned over the last couple of years, just because I haven't spoken it in the last 3 years. But I find it really difficult for me personally to learn languages. I need a one-on-one, like, instructor teacher to help me. I need to do a little bit more lessons, but I love learning new languages.
So does this impede your ability to enjoy the cultures and travel, or do you find ways around it?
Definitely doesn't limit the ability. I think it will limit your ability if you're too afraid to try and communicate. So when I was relearning Spanish, so I learned Spanish in high school, in college, but didn't use any of it for, I don't know, 12, 13 years.
Right.
So I had to relearn Spanish when I started traveling. And not only relearn, I had to unlearn the wrong improper Spanish that I learned and then relearn the proper way. And I will say that once you accept the fact that you don't know the language and you're okay with that,
yeah,
and you're okay with having a little humility, it gets a lot easier and it gets a lot better. I cannot tell you the amount of times where I'm at a pharmacy or I'm at a grocery store and it's charades. I'm like, lo siento, like, I'm so sorry, I don't know the word, but like this, and you laugh, I laugh, and eventually we find what I'm trying to find, and it's very entertaining.
And probably a lesson for both parties and for me as well. I can totally understand that, appreciate it, and have seen it, you know, you see it wherever you go. And as long as you come to it with a little bit of, as you mentioned, humility, you're going to be able to find a way or some common ground to move forward. I can picture that in my head. Ashley Kay is our guest. She is the author of the travel blog, Hi from Ashley. She's from Wisconsin, but has been traveling the world since the end of 2019, and right now is spending the day in Bermuda, where it's hot and sunny, humid, but not like the hot and sunny and humid we have here in Wisconsin. It's got more beaches. If you've got questions about her travels and her camper truck, you can give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email, talk@wpr.org. And if you've got a story of travels of your own, or if you've done some overlanding that you'd like to share, please join us. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Tomorrow on Garden Talk with Larry Mueller, we'll hear from the author of a new book that's exploring how mystery writers are using gardening and gardeners in their books. And we'll talk with an expert about growing succulents to be their best. That's tomorrow on Garden Talk with Larry Mueller from 11 to 1 here on WPR News. But right now, we're talking with traveler overlander Ashley Kay, author of the travel blog Hi from Ashley. You'll also find her on YouTube and TikTok and all the socials. She's been traveling around the world since 2019. And if you've got questions for her, join us, 1-800-642-1234. You'll also find a link to her blog at wpr.org/Ashley and /Larry, sorry. And Ashley, what's the most beautiful of the most beautiful that you've seen? If I were to take one trip based on all your travels, what would my destination be?
I would probably put Peru at the top of the list, depending on the type of adventure that you're looking for. But Peru has definitely everything in one country.
And it's not, I mean, it's a small country too, right? It's not.
It's quite large.
You've got a lot to see. It's quite large.
Yeah. I mean, if you drive from northern Peru to southern Peru, if you went straight through along the coast, I believe it's a 24-hour drive.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it's quite a large country.
Let's go to your questions now for our guest, Ashley Kay. Sue in Blue River, good afternoon.
Hi.
What's your question?
Hi, Sue.
Hello. My question, actually, you kind of just answered it, but what was your favorite adventure?
Favorite adventure of all time? I would say the glacial lakes in Peru were probably the most mind-blowing. Like, I can't believe I'm here.
What was that like?
It's just, I find certain spaces in nature where you're so overwhelmed by the size or the vast space that you're looking at.
Sure.
Just, it changes your perspective so much on life and who you are. And that was just incredible. Like, how does this even exist?
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful.
I get that. Like, it's tough to change somebody's opinion, or your opinion is pretty much set in stone. But if you can change a perspective, the way you look, the size of your horizon, then your opinions will change with it. I've always seen it that way. And the glacial lakes, do you like make a point of returning to Peru? Is that a place you've gone back to already? Or is that some place you plan to return to someday?
I have not returned to Peru, but I absolutely will at some point in time. I still have a very long list of places that I want to get to for photography that I just wasn't able to get through because I was traveling through rain season. So one day I will return.
Deb emailed and wanted to know what your time was like during the pandemic, Ashley.
There were some pros and cons to be fair. Definitely traveling was very limited, but there were some also really incredible experiences that I would have never been able to have if the world were shut down. So,
Interesting. There was a silver lining in that for you.
Yeah, it was definitely some solid silver lining moments. Two things to be shared, I guess. So in Bermuda, Horseshoe Bay is one of the best beaches in the entire world. And I have never liked it because it is full of tourists. Like, the cruise ships come in and there are just hundreds of people across the beach. And during COVID, there was nobody. And I was like, oh, this is amazing.
Yeah.
This is why this beach is one of the best in the entire world. I see it now. I can feel it. I can enjoy it. And then the second experience that was really mind-blowing, my friend James and I went to French Polynesia. We went to the island of Fakarava to go scuba diving for the Wall of Sharks. It's an island owned by a family, little bungalows, restaurant, dive shop, very basic. For the first 3 or 4 days we were there, not a single other person, just the two of us, just private dinners, private guides, diving, just the two. It was absolutely incredible. And no other time in history before scuba diving became popular in that place have people probably got to experience that environment in that way.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Just every single day we're like, how lucky are we right now that we're here? This is incredible.
Let's go to Frank and Racine next. Frank, good afternoon. You're on the Larry Mueller Show with Ashley Kay.
Yes, great. I wanted to ask about the Darien jungle, why you had to, I forgot the term for getting on a boat and going around the obstacle. There is a term for that, but I forgot that. But why did you have to do that when you got to the Darien jungle going to from Panama to Colombia?
Yeah, Frank, thank you for the question. Why did you have to ship the Toyota Tacoma, Ashley?
Good question. So there is no physical road that connects from Panama to Colombia. The Darien Gap is mainly swamp, mountainous. It's always 95 degrees and up. There is a lot of rain that happens in that area. So when it rains, there are mudslides, landslides, and then it's a very unique biosphere in the world. So a lot of animals, but a lot of poisonous, venomous animals, bats, snakes, spiders, everything. So that's just the environment. And then you have indigenous communities that live within those areas. It's a very high human trafficking area. You have a lot of migrants who are walking through that area. And when you have environments like that, you will also have like gorillas in that area and can be very dangerous in that way. And yeah, you just can't do it. There's no road. There have been, I believe, 12 people that have traversed it in history. I believe it was Range Rover who sent in a group of Brits with like 4 or 5 vehicles, and it cost like $500,000. They were airdropping liquor and gas and cigarettes to them. But yeah, very, very impossible as a normal person.
Without $500,000 and an unlimited supply of liquor and cigarettes.
Yeah, they were pretty cool story. If you look that up on the internet machine, it's pretty cool to read about.
Frank, I am so glad you asked. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Perry and Oconto next. Perry, good afternoon.
Hey, thanks, Ashley, for sharing your story. My question is, when you're in the camper, how did you find places to stop? Because I'm just imagining you're not stopping at regular campgrounds like we know in Wisconsin. And were you traveling alone most of the time? And how did you deal with safety and feeling safe in different countries?
Yeah, thank you, Perry. Ashley?
Very good question. Always top of the list. So as far as safety on the day-to-day stuff, I had already been traveling for 3.5 years. So a lot of that stuff is just second nature built in already. As far as feeling safe about leaving almost everything I own inside of my truck and walking away and going into stores and, oh my goodness, is somebody going to break into it? What if they steal my laptop or my camera? I had that for a few weeks and then just reached a point where you just have to let it go. Because if somebody wants to break in and steal, they're going to, no matter what you do, it's going to happen. So all of my camera gear, photography stuff is all insured. Everything is replaceable. You can't spend all of your energy thinking about that. As far as traveling alone, safety as a woman, I don't know how to say this properly or politically correct, but I don't have any major concerns. I feel incredibly safe in Latin America. I feel safer in Latin American countries than I do in the United States. And that's just the honest truth. People ask me every single day, are you alone? And I say, yes, I'm alone. And once they find out that you're alone, they keep an extra eye out for you. I one time had to camp at a truck stop in Honduras, and they put an armed guard at my truck the entire night. He was there when I left in the morning. So men, women around the world, once they find that you're alone traveling this way, they're going to go out of their way to make sure that you're okay. They're going to invite you over to the camp. I mean, I can't even list how many times complete strangers have helped me in Guatemala. A man who lived there, he's in a Toyota overlanding club, let me stay in his cottage on Lake Atitlan for 1 month. Just absolutely kind, hospitable, amazing people everywhere that I've been. As far as camping goes, I am obsessed with maps. So I am looking at the destination that I want to get to. And then where is it? Is there a road that I can get to? I use an app called iOverlander quite a bit to find free wild camping. And that is definitely a personal thing that I've noticed, me versus other travelers. A lot of other travelers are going to campgrounds. They are going to paid facilities, or they will camp like a gas station parking lot. And I will not. I am looking for a four-wheel drive, off-grid, 4 hours up the mountain. And if somebody is going to come 4 hours up the mountain to find little old me, I mean, I don't think so.
Ashley Kay, thank you so much for joining us today and allowing us to live vicariously through your travels. It has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find follow Ashley and her travels on the travel blog, hifromashley.com, or YouTube page, TikTok, and all the social medias. Want to thank everybody on our team for making these conversations possible today. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. Join Larry Mueller for The Larry Mueller Show tomorrow for Garden Talk. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you are listening to WPR News.
I've been everywhere, man.